Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Merry Christmas, Savage Nation. And here is a gift for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best from May of 2010. You want me to tell you what happened at the museum, a night at the museum? I'm not sure you want to hear about the exhibit, the closed, it had never been open to the public, Birth of Impressionism. So I went, I was invited, because I happen to love Impressionist paintings. Who doesn't? We all grew up on them. I mean, everybody grew up on Impressionist paintings. Everybody who went to college had to study the Impressionists, right? And so many of you say, ah, that's passe, we don't look at it anymore. Who needs it? We know all about it. You don't know all about it. In fact, I went there and found three new paintings that I didn't know existed. I take that back. I did know they existed. One of them I knew existed. The Floor Scrapers from 1875 by Calabot. Unbelievable. Raboteurs de Parquet, to show you I know French. The Magpie by Monet, 1868. And then most important to me, which was the painting that was very political, The Escape of Rochefort by Manet. Now, why did that painting have any relevance for me? The Escape of Rochefort. I'm going to read this to you for 1 minute, and then we'll move on to straight politics. But I want to read this to you. It caught me. It's basically a picture of a sea. And in the midst of this big painting of a sea, there's a small picture of men in a rowboat. And you read it. Edouard Manet, The Escape of Rochefort, 1881. And just listen to the paragraph. It doesn't matter whether you went to college or not. Henri Rochefort founded the controversial political journal La Lanterne, The Lantern, and was actively opposed to the imperial regime of Napoleon III. Sounds like Obama I, doesn't it? This led to his involvement in the Paris Commune, for which he was imprisoned. Press freedom, anyone? Manet depicts Rochefort's daring escape from a French prison colony in New Caledonia. Intended for the Salon of 1881, Manet's political commentary transforms the recent past into modern history. Amen, does it ever. It's interesting to me that they didn't kill political opponents. They didn't send out Secret Service agents or secret agents to spy on them. Well, they arrested them and they, you know, excommunicated them, in this case, to New Caledonia, which you have to understand how far away New Caledonia is and how far away New Caledonia was from Paris in the 1880s. If you've been to any part of the South Pacific, you realize it may as well be the end of the world. That he escaped is astounding. But that brings us front and center to today, which is the art of today. Art of today, from the political, it's become the polemical. I'm going to ask you a simple question. You don't have to be educated. You don't have to like art to answer this question, right? Here's the question. Can you name one artist in the United States of America? Name one. You can't. Can you name any artist from France who speaks today for France? Can you name one German artist? No, you don't know of any because there are none. It doesn't mean there aren't people who are painting, there aren't people who are sculpting, there are. But there are no prominent artists in any Western nation. So you say, wait a minute, how did this happen? How did we wind up in a place where there are no artists that we know of? How come we don't know of an artist in America? Can you name one scientist in America? You can't. How come there's not one prominent scientist? In other words, if you look back 50 years, you all heard of Jonas Salk. You heard of a physicist named Albert Einstein. You know what I'm saying? The giants. How come there are no giants in the sciences, the arts today? There's an answer to that as well. In my opinion, I have the answer for that. It has to do with liberalism. Liberalism deconstructed the entire West, all of Western civilization, and destroyed it. And the reason they deconstructed Western civilization is to enable themselves to reconstruct it in the image of a gigantic new Sovietized world where there is no art, except art which serves the state. Witness the Obama posters during the campaign, where there is no science other than science which supports the government. Do you follow what I'm saying to you? You have to understand where I'm coming from to understand what I'm saying at all. So I attended an art show at the De Young Museum, classical paintings from the Impressionist era, and I was again taken in by their beauty. But I ask you, where in America today are such works of art being created? Can you name one artist today that creates works of art on the level of a Degas or Renoir? Well, what's amazing is that even the art of that era was sometimes political, as I just showed you. But in the world of art, we've gone from the political to the polemical. Can you think of a single artist today whose art is intended to uplift instead of to offend? Can you think of an artist who describes instead of degrades? Can you think of an artist who reveres instead of reviles America? There's no one. No Western nation currently produces great artists or sculptors, and it's because of the same left-wing ism that has destroyed our political system. The very same left that would laud a loser like Woody Allen, who wishes that there would be a dictatorship where Obama could be a dictator if it wasn't for those nasty Republicans. This is from a Jew. This is from a liberal Jew who wishes for a dictatorship. This is why I've told you years ago that you actually shouldn't fear these people. You should pity them. Liberalism is a mental disorder, a very serious one. What Woody Allen doesn't know is that when the Nazis rose to power in Germany, and that was a dictatorship, I guess that was a bad dictatorship. It certainly was, but to Woody Allen, there was only one bad dictatorship. That was that of Nazi Germany. But I guess the Soviet Union had a good dictatorship under Stalin. Now, what did the Germans do? The Nazis took many of the great works of art, which they considered to be degenerate, and removed them from museums, particularly the art of Jews. They took away the art of Chagall, Kandinsky, and they removed them from public view, but they didn't destroy them. No, did they? Not at all. Ironically, those paintings and many other classical works of art were stolen and hoarded by high-ranking officials of the Nazi regime. Now, what happened in Russia is after the Russian Revolution, the Bolsheviks tried to put all art into the service of the dictatorship of the proletariat. Stalin issued a decree, quote, on the reconstruction of literary and art organizations, and only art in the, quote, socialist realism style was allowed. What does this have to do with America today? Well, listen, the Nazis and the Soviets were both socialist regimes. Never be deceived. We know the Soviets were socialist, that you know, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic. But you didn't know that the Nazis were socialist until I told you this 4 years ago. And they allowed only art that fell in line with their extreme political agenda. And what did they do? They depicted muscled factory workers and overalls struggling in a steel foundry, or heroic visions of soldiers hearkening back to the Roman Empire. These paintings, posters, and sculptures were propaganda, not real art. And so you go even to China under Mao Zedong. Remember the peasant posters of the noble peasant working in the field? Again, that's an example of state-sponsored art. And what's happening today? That's the real question. Well, what's happening today is that real art has been hollowed out and replaced with garbage that serves the needs of the state. Do you realize that great art is by its very nature conservative? That crap art is by its very nature liberal? A great painting conserves a moment in time or an emotion so that it can be experienced by future generations. The conservative bees build up the hive. The progressive termites tear down the hive. They critique art, they impose meanings upon it that are designed to further their far-left political agendas. And so the art that is created by leftists is destructive. For example, a painting of the Virgin Mary in elephant dung, a crucifix in a jar of urine, or a mindless repetition of images such as Andy Warhol's soup cans. Why was that designed? What is it designed for? Well, all of those pieces of dreck were designed to render the very structure of art meaningless. Remember, the goal of liberal, postmodern, deconstructive art is to tear down the old institutions like the Catholic Church, the family, the nation, and replace them with chaos. And then in that chaos, there is an environment ripe for takeover by a monolithic dictatorial view of culture in which only one opinion on an issue is allowed, and that is the opinion of the government. And in the world of art, this means giant posters of the great leader mounted on every empty wall, as we saw with the Obama posters that appeared in 2008. In the political world, it means a dictatorship, the kind of dictatorship that Woody Allen and other so-called members of the progressive art community wish Obama had. The left has deconstructed art And now the left is trying to deconstruct our nation as well. What do I have to tell you? What do I have to tell you? It's the sad state of affairs that we're living in a country. I don't know whose country it is. I know it's not mine. I know that I am not living in the America I grew up in, that I used to wake up in the morning and feel like the luckiest person on earth. My parents told me how the world was around me and how everybody wanted to come here. I used to wake up in the morning and feel lucky just to be an American when I knew how bad it was everywhere else on earth. And then I wake up one day and I start to feel, wait a minute, how did this country become almost like a third world nation? How did patriots in this country become suspect? How did deviants and other such individuals suddenly become revered? How is it that every movie that is made is not about a hero, but about a degenerate criminal? How is it possible that there are so many sick people in so many positions of power? How is it that every crime that is committed, the suspect is immediately a white male? How far have we fallen so fast in the United States of America? I ask myself every morning as I awaken and every night as I go to sleep. That's the truth. That's one man's opinion. If you don't agree with me, you know what? It's too damn bad. I'm an Aries, and I'll tell you the way I see it. If it matches, fine. If it's a blood donation that matches, take it as a transfusion. If it's a blood donation that causes toxicity, then go listen to some schmuck show on NPR where you get your daily dose of seditiousness and cowardice. Because I am sick and tired of mincing words.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. Here is the best from May of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Last night, I live in a small town part-time, so I see six fire trucks. The show is over. I come home. Six fire trucks, police cars, police action, cops running back and forth. The streets closed off. I'm looking. I don't know what's going on. The firemen are running. The police are running. So I got the dog. I walked down the street with Teddy, and I inquire what happened. Apparently, it was a kitchen fire that my mother would have put out with a bottle of seltzer. Six fire trucks, six police cars, the street closed off. So I jokingly said to my neighbors, they came from four different surrounding towns. I'm not kidding you. A kitchen fire that you could have put out with a glass of water. Two punks live in there with their mother, apparently. They could have doused it out with a bottle of soda. Four trucks or six trucks and sirens, and the street closed down, three departments. They all came running because they can write it on the books that they went to put out a fire. So I said to the neighbor, I guess they've justified their pensions here. So they laughed. You think people don't know what's going on? I mean, you think people are stupid? This is not to denigrate the individual fireman or the individual cop. But we all know that the pensions are unsupportable. We all understand that. And we all understand that civil service jobs today are golden. They're the golden jobs of America today. New York, Tom, WOR, you're up on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
God bless you, Michael, as ever. Michael, I'm really wondering if Mother England is getting ready to jump to partner with the devil. First, they banned Michael Savage, a world and American patriot from Britain, and now they want to put the Holy Father in handcuffs. This is unacceptable, Michael.
What do you mean by the Holy Father in handcuffs? Oh, they want to arrest the Pope.
If he's foolish enough to go there.
Well, look, that's why we were all praying for a rational government in England to get rid of the socialist degenerate. The socialist degenerate Gordon Brown has wrecked England, destroyed it, absolutely decimated it. But it doesn't look like there's it's going to be a hung parliament, but it's not well hung enough towards the conservatives for us to get optimistic.
And who's calling the shots over there? The goodness or evil, Michael?
Well, I mean, you're asking me a philosophical question for which there's no answer. How do I know who's calling the shots? Probably somebody in Pakistan in a cave.
How could they even think about putting the Holy Father in handcuffs? That's outrageous. What's wrong with that country?
Well, let's have another discussion about merry old England. And it's one I want to have had for years. I've wanted to have for years. Why do they tolerate a royal family that doesn't work? Can anyone explain that to me?
Because they're just drunk on it, Michael. It's like the Kennedy kooks here.
Should England, a Western democracy, tolerate a leech royal family that does nothing but live off the largesse of thieving ancestors, to put it in plain English, since we're talking about England? So let's raise the question. Should the royal family, should the Queen, in other words, be, let's say, dismissed as a figure in England? What Western democracy has a queen or a king? You know, they're all leeches. They're parasites on the people. They don't work. You know, there's no point in getting any more about it, saying any more about it. Do they work? Do they do anything for the people? No. They're living on the past, which was all based upon plunder and exploitation.
Worship gods.
Well, I don't, I mean, that's an issue that, you know, years ago I used to hear, have this discussion. I would say, well, the Queen is an important figure. Why? Why is she important? What does she do for the people of England? Drive around in Rolls Royces and the jerk Prince Charles paints pictures and talks about global warming? The guy is a lunatic. He has no knowledge of reality. At least one of his sons is in the military. I mean, he made an attempt to be a human being. Yeah, no one wants to talk about the Queen of England. Play God Save the Queen while I'm looking for the next story I want to talk about here. I want to... Could you play God Save the Queen?
God Save the Queen!
That's all.
The fascist regime!
Sounds good.
It made you a moron! Potential hate bomb! God Save the Queen! She ain't no human being!
Artists and poets get it right sometimes. I mean, the Sex Pistols were ahead of their time. Who would have thunk, huh? Would you have ever thought the Sex Pistols would be so brilliantly ahead of their time? I mean, even a junkie gets it right a couple of times in their life. All right, they got the point already. I'm going to talk about these and other topics even if the rest of the media refuses to. Talk Radio Network, which is an independent syndicator. I have no pressures that I don't have the pressures that people who syndicate with big companies do where they have to answer to a lower authority.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I never picked him out. He picked me out.
They trained for 8 hours a day. But that's the only person the dog knew.
Their smell and hearing is so acute.
I couldn't imagine going into a jungle without a dog.
I know they were close before they ever got there.
But oh my God, they're shooting their bullets.
They saved hundreds of lives, including mine.
There isn't a day that goes by that I don't think of that dog.
All right, so I one of my favorite channels is military history, or the history channels in general, or National Geographic. I stumbled upon War Dogs of the Pacific documentary story of the Marine dog platoons of World War II. And they show these men, the Marines, they must be in their 80s when they were interviewed for this, or older. And these are the men who saved us from Hitler. These are the men without whom we would be speaking German or we'd be lampshades. These are the men who, when you look at them, I mean, they bring tears to your eyes. And then they flash back to these men in Saipan when they were in their 20s. You see the young man and the old man. And when they were young men, they were dog handlers. And the dogs were largely either, what were they, Doberman Pinschers or German Shepherds. And the interesting part was is that they were given to these men by ordinary American citizens, and they were trained to kill. They were trained to hunt out Japanese in the jungles. And you look at the tales of devotion and bravery and sacrifice by the dog handlers themselves and the dogs, and the bond between the men and the dogs from Saipan, Okinawa, and Iwo Jima. These are the best, and just the best men America has ever seen, and we still have many of them, believe me, in the military. Best men in the world, and that's why I supported them when Bush permitted them to be hung out and dried with false court martials. Some of them are still hanging out there. I gave my own money. Many of you contributed money to Colonel Chesani's cause because Bush could have pardoned them. He never did. Instead, he pardoned drug dealers and other criminals. It's unbelievable what these two administrations have done to our military. So when I look back, when I watch these documentaries of World War II and I see the faces, these are ordinary Americans fighting the hardest kind of fight there is, you know, hand-to-hand combat, smoking out the Japanese in caves, also very hard men. And you reach a point where you see the dogs. Now, these guys are now doing jungle fighting. They're afraid of snipers, Japanese snipers. A man's senses can only see and hear and smell so far. But a dog's senses are hundreds of times greater, obviously. So a dog is, I think, 400 times greater sense of scent than a man. Never mind the hearing, okay? So they're in the jungle now. They're creeping along, hoping they don't get killed from a Japanese sniper, let us say, on Okinawa or Iwo Jima or Saipan. And they need a dog. So they got the dogs now. The dogs now are let go, and the dogs go ahead of them. The dog can hear a Japanese sniper in a tree 100 yards away. So they knock him out of the tree. Many, many American men were able to live, come home, contribute to society, create a family because of the dogs. They saved many lives in the Pacific. And if you watch this, and then you see that the Japanese learn that the dogs were real threats to them, they started shooting the dogs first. And then they flash back to one of the older gentlemen who was a Marine in one of these theaters of operation. And he says, after they shot one of our dogs, we really got mad. And you see the grit come out in this guy. And, you know, when he says we really got mad. But then you see other scenes in there that are going to rip your guts out. For example, one of the dog handlers, remember, these dogs were trained to kill, number one. They were ordinary dogs from households, voluntarily given to the military. They were trained to attack and kill by military dog handlers. They had to be trained to kill. So now they're trained to kill. They're brought out into the islands to help fight the Japanese in World War II. And so they're also trained to kill anyone who tries to hurt their handler. Talk about, you know, loyalty. They show one of the handlers getting shot. The Marine medic goes in to treat him. The dog lets the medic treat the handler. When the man dies, the dog suddenly becomes atavistic, growls, snaps, and threatens the Americans who want to come near the dead body. You look at a thing like this, and, you know, you have to understand, you have to own a dog to understand what this scene is. That the dog, trained to protect that man, will protect that man's corpse with his life. It's unbelievable. Then you see men whose dogs get killed who go to pieces. You see men feeding the dogs the last of their own rations. You see men giving the dog the last bit of food that they have. The dog becomes the last thing they have that they love in the world, in the middle of the hell that they were put. Then you see scenes of men who go to pieces. There was one scene in passing. I had seen something like this once before in my life, of men who break down in combat. I saw this before. I may have seen it in passing in some of the in documentaries, but there was one scene that was astounding. Now, you're talking about the hardest men who were sent out into these island fights, hand-to-hand combat, the most horrendous, gut-tearing stuff you could ever imagine. We can only imagine what these men had to live through. I don't know if men could do this anymore. I really don't know if anyone could do it in the America of today. I truly don't know if they could do this anymore. I wonder if there are men left that could do this, or they're all locked up in Pelican Bay. I'm not sure anymore. I watched this show, and you see a man who broke down from the combat, from the ugliness, from the horror of the blood and the guts and the killing and the murder. And he's crying like a baby, sucking his thumb. It's unbelievable to see this in the middle of this. And another Marine is holding him with his arm around him. And he's sitting there crying and shuddering like a baby, sucking his own thumb. He had a total crack up in the midst of this ugly, horrendous combat. Now, this was in passing. But, you know, we're talking about something else, which is the dog thing, the war dogs of the Pacific. But I'm bringing that up as a side note. Okay, so now the war ends. The Army shoots their dogs. You hear this? The Army decides that all the dogs that fought so loyally in World War II should be killed. They shoot all the dogs that they used. The Marines refused to go along with the program. In other words, in those days, they would not be obotomized. The Marines said, go to hell, we're not shooting our dogs, we'll shoot you first. So the Marines said, we're not shooting them. We're not going to go along with the Obama program of the day, in other words, just because Big Brother told us to. We'll shoot you first. We're not killing our dogs. They were our best friend. They kept us alive, dropped dead. So the Marine Corps backs up the fat asses back home who decided to shoot the dogs suddenly. The fat asses back in Camp Lejeune who never fought suddenly get frightened of the Marines and say, all right, we won't kill the dogs. Meanwhile, they have 540 killer dogs in their hands, and they don't know what to do with them. So you know what the men say? We will retrain them to become domesticated again. And they work 12, 15 hours a day, and they do teach old dogs new tricks, and they retrain them to be able to integrate back with families. So out of the 540 or so dogs that fought with the men in the Pacific who were killers, trained to kill, only four had to be euthanized. It's a story that is astounding, and I would highly recommend that you try to catch War Dogs of the Pacific on the Military History Channel when it's replayed, and I don't know when it'll be replayed. The historical footage and never-before-seen photos are astounding, and it was done by a director named Harris Dunn, who was a graduate of the USC School of Cinema, and he earned a degree in film production. But he did, thrillers such as, family comedies, Bonjour, Buddy. But this feature documentary directing debut with War Dogs of the Pacific about the Marine War dog handlers of World War II is astounding. Any dog lover should watch this, and it'll give you a new appreciation for not only the intelligence of dogs, the loyalty of dogs, but the devotion and the bravery and sacrifice of the United States Marine Corps. This is the Savage Nation. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Phone number 1-800-449-8255. Let's go to Washington, D.C., WTNT. Jay, go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
Yeah, it's Michael. I've been waiting for somebody to talk about this subject a long time. Actually, one of the Marines that was instrumental in keeping those dogs from being killed was a gentleman named Colonel William Putney. Putney has a book you can read. It's called, of all things, it's called Semper Fi. It's about the third war dog company, and it discusses those many subjects that you've just gone over.
But he stood up to the Marine Corps brass and said, we're not killing them, I guess. That's what he had to do.
Correct. And his men loved him. All those families that got him. But he was alive up until about 4 years ago and passed away. But
there goes the last, where are they today? When they go and fight in Iraq, if they actually do the right job that they're trained to do, they get court-martialed by George Bush in the last administration and probably with Michael Mullen now in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. A guy's afraid to fire a gun without consulting a manual.
He would have been outed. I mean, he would have never been on the Admiral Staff or flag officer back then. This Colonel Putney, as far as I'm concerned, he should have got the Medal of Honor. But read that book, Semper Fi. And the one thing I want to say,
let me ask you, Jay, where is the dog cemetery that I saw at the end of the documentary? They apparently have a cemetery of these dogs somewhere. Where is that?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I'd have to go back.
I couldn't believe it. It was an actual war memorial cemetery for these heroic dogs. It was unbelievable. Thank you for the call. Here we have a caller from Los Angeles who says he knew Colonel Putney. Steve on KGIL, thank you for calling. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I knew Dr. Putney. Guam was where they have the statue.
In Guam, that's where the dog's cemetery is.
Cemetery there. I met Dr. Savage Dr. Putney when I was like 23 years old. He was 50 years old. We were the best of friends. We used to play golf together once a week.
What did he tell you about the whole dog program, Steve, that you could share with the audience today?
You know what? We became such good friends. I used to go. He had a dog kennel down in, Canoga Park that I used to go down with him all the time.
And you mean this was after the war, of course?
We're talking 1970, 73, 74.
So what I'm hearing is he continued his love for dogs into the latter part of his life, long after the war.
I think he passed away about 4 years ago. Yeah, he was a veterinarian when he passed away about 4 years ago.
Oh, he was a vet. The colonel was a veteran?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, was a veterinarian? The vet was a veterinarian?
Oh, yes.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, big time. He talked to
me. And, Steve, did he tell you any stories of the war that would be worth sharing right now?
Yes. He says, you know, when we're out in the walking around in the bushes and everything else and leading dogs, he was so much the leader because he was the lieutenant. I think he went up to, like, captain or, you know, I don't remember. But, you know what?
That's okay. I'm going to tell. Thank you very much for that sharing. Now he brought back a memory from the documentary. Let me throw one more piece in. After the men had shown how good these dogs were in combat, they were rewarded with another stripe. They were moved up the ranks. And then the commander said to them, but because you've moved up from corporal, you can no longer be a dog handler because that's for a lower ranked man. The men, almost to a man, ripped the stripe off their body and said, we'd rather remain a corporal in order to stay with our dogs. No, thank you. You can keep your stripe.
Welcome back, Mr. and Mrs. North and South America and all the ships at sea. Let's go to press. I don't care if you're in light air, light breeze, gentle breeze, moderate breeze, fresh breeze, strong breeze, near gale, gale, strong gale, storm, violent storm, or hurricane. Wherever you are on the Beaufort scale, you're welcome on the Savage Nation. Let's go to San Diego. Don, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Savage. There's a real easy way to kill those flies on your sailboat. If you blow on them lightly, since they're used to being on the ocean, and when the wind blows, they tend to cling on to you. You blow on them lightly, you can swat them in no problem.
Wait, say that again. You blow on them lightly, and what, they get stupefied from the halitosis?
Yeah, it delays their reaction. No, not from the halitosis. They're just used to being on the windy ocean, so when you blow on them, they cling on so they don't get blown away. And
oh, like if they've alighted on your dashboard. So you blow on them so they stick to it to figure they're going to be blown off, and then you swat them?
Absolutely.
I'm not a sailor. I admire people who know how to sail. I don't like particularly dodging them on the weekend in San Francisco Bay because they won't vary their course by 1 degree. But they'd rather have a head-on collision than change 1 degree. You have a powerboat, so I don't have to move, you schmuck. Meanwhile, you all have a collision. You never saw such arrogance, the sailors. I'm a very defensive boat driver. I usually divert. I'll move the... But you should see the idiots in the sailboats. I have a sailboat, and I have the right of way, and I don't care if we kill everybody. I'm not changing course by one iota. Not 1 degree off. Not 2 degrees. I'm staying on my course, you schmucks, you. I never saw such stupidity as I see in sailors on the bay. New York Joe, you're on the Savage Nation from WOR. What's on your mind, Joe?
I'd like to ask you about organized religion. I know that you believe in moral absolutes. And I'm not sure if this is what you mean when you say that you don't believe in organized religion. But like David Skolansky said, who was a famous poker player, he said, if there's 100 religions in the world, 99 have to be wrong. Is that what you mean when you say you don't believe in organized religion?
Well, I've heard something like that before from someone, which is that all the religions can't be right if they all say that only their God is the only way. I understand that. But I would say that that's a distortion of man's view of God rather than a distortion of God himself.
Well, to that I would say, why would the superior being be condescending to the inferior being? Why not would he require it the other way around?
What do you mean by condescending? In what manner?
He's asking the inferior being, which is man. He's pandering to him rather than saying be like me. He's saying I'll be like you.
I really can't follow you. I really don't know what you. I mean, I understand that you're a smart guy and you're an atheist, and you want to convince me that atheism is the clever way to follow. But get back to me after you have cancer. I mean, God forbid. Tell me if you're still an atheist.
I love your show. I really do.
Okay, I'm joking. Look, I pray to God you don't get it. But you know, you never had a bad night where you prayed to God.
No, I pray to God all the time, and that's why I'm asking you. I see cognitive dissonance in your reasoning, where you do believe...
No, okay, no, I'm being facetious, and I don't mean to be nasty, but I didn't know where you were coming from. You sound like a lawyer I know who I don't particularly like right now. You have the same voice, so forgive me. I was reacting as though it was him. So let's start from the top. Let me give you my religious view. Years ago, I read a book where a religious man wrote a book. It was a popular book. And he said that he doesn't believe God is omnipotent, just omnipresent. And that if he believed God was omnipotent, he would give up his all religion immediately. That made more sense to me than anything. What does he mean by God is not omnipotent? Meaning God cannot control minutiae on the planet, meaning every little act of every little man, every little animal, right? But God is ever present. God is everywhere, but God does not control everyone's motions and every act. And that made sense to me. Does that make sense to you?
Because of my religious beliefs, I have to disagree with that. I do believe in God's sovereignty over even man's free will.
Okay, hold on. This is very interesting. So if a man is walking down the street and he's crossing the street with his three daughters and a car strikes them in the crosswalk and two of his daughters are killed but he is not and one daughter is maimed, that's God's will?
I would say that's God's will, and I already know where you're going with this. How can God punish innocent children?
No.
I would say,
how about in Connecticut? You're telling me that 11-year-old girl deserves to be raped and set on fire by those two animals? That was their just dessert for what? What did they do?
I don't know what they did. I am not omnipresent, as you said before, like God.
So you mean she committed a crime worse than, let's say, a mass murderer who's been protected by the liberals for 30 years on death row? So she should have been punished immediately. But the guy on death row who actually raped and murdered a 15-year-old who's been protected for 30 years, he shouldn't be punished immediately.
No, these are things that I can't explain. I can't explain the higher mind of God, the modes of his reasoning.
Okay, so what I'm saying to you is this book that I read, the book was called Peace of Mind, and he was trying to describe the highest state that man can achieve in an ordinary man's life. The highest state you can achieve is peace of mind without medication, right?
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best from May of 2010. I'm going to talk about Playboy magazine because the interview appeared. I got it on the internet. It was sent to me by the company to my producer. And I started to read it. Some of it's good. Some of it's unfair. You know, what did I expect? Playboy interviewing Michael Savage? Did you expect him to make me look good? They tried their best to make me look bad. But I'm going to ask you who looks worse, me or the editor, David Hochman. I want to quote the beginning of the article, Michael Savage Playboy interview. I'm going to read from it today. And I want to ask you something. Listen to what the editor of this article writes at the bottom of his introduction. Contributing editor David Hochman spent more than 16 hours interviewing Savage, says Hochman, quote, "I can't remember a more difficult interview. Savage was a fine host, but his opinions are extreme to the point of being poison. Much of the time I hated him. He's maddeningly bullheaded and closed-minded, but he was just as leery of me. Even when we were laughing, I knew he was thinking liberal vermin media." I got to tell you, I didn't once think liberal vermin media, David. In fact, I'm so naive, I thought that I liked you and I thought you liked me. What you have here is a classic portrait of a paranoid, deceptive, backstabbing liberal who pretended he was a nice guy. Never once did he seem disagreeable to me. I didn't think that we agreed politically, but I didn't think he'd go out of his way to try and stick a knife in me. I mean, he only stuck it in himself. He says, "Even when we were laughing, I knew he was thinking liberal vermin media. I didn't think it once. Now I do. Now I do. Now I'm even doubly sure that everyone in the liberal vermin media is a liberal and a vermin. I didn't think it once. So let's begin at the beginning. Michael Savage, Playboy interview. And he writes this. Shall I begin from the beginning? Two kinds of people listen to talk radio in 2010. Those who think Michael Savage is a nut job and those who think he's right. The Savage Nation has daily his daily broadcast reaches an estimated 8 million to 10 million listeners a week. And even his haters admit the show is like radio crack and wildly unpredictable. 1 minute Savage is railing against illegal immigration or advocating work camps for the homeless. The next he's getting misty over a Walt Whitman couplet or cuddling his poodle Teddy. Savage abhors whiny liberalism and the Prius elite, even as he plays up his lefty credentials. A PhD from Berkeley, years of association with tree huggers, gays, and beatniks, and a home base in, the San Francisco Bay Area. But he's just as hard on conservatives. Ask him, if you dare, about Dubya or Glenn Beck. Savage likes to call himself an independent-minded individualist. First of all, that whole paragraph makes no sense. You're telling me that a PhD from Berkeley makes me into a liberal? You mean nobody who has achieved a PhD from Berkeley could be possibly be a conservative? Don't you see the bias in the minds of these people? Then he says, and guess where he lives? The San Francisco Bay Area. You'd think I'm the only person in San Francisco Bay Area who thinks this way. What world do these people live in? So then he talks about me and he talks about my family, even though I specified in the beginning, do not bring my family into it, and he agreed to it. But, you know, it's like the scorpion and the frog. He was the scorpion, I was the frog. What did I expect? The problem here for him is that he tried to sting me and he got stung by his own poison. So let's begin at the beginning. Playboy, why are you so angry, Michael Savage? Savage, do I look angry? Playboy says, a little. You definitely sound angry. Savage, well, I get worked up. First of all, I get angry because I can't believe I live in a country that's so effing stupid it lets every group in the world come here. Please let us in. Fine. Let us come in on asylum because our country will kill us. No problem. Then the minute they get here, they turn around and sue the country, make demands on the country, won't learn the language, won't salute the flag, and all they do is disparage the country. Playboy, you've neatly boiled it down to a problem of borders, language, and culture, correct? Savage, it's my definition of how our nation is defined and why it's unraveling. It's also a framework. Here are our borders. Here is our language. Here is our culture. If you want to live in America, wonderful, but become one of us. If you want to practice your home language, do it at home or in your own community. Playboy, that sort of rabid nationalism can quickly lead to xenophobia, which in turn can... Well, remember what happened in the 1930s in Germany? Savage, bull crap. That's typical left-wing horse crap. I don't even understand what they're talking about. What, I'm Hitler because I'm against illegal immigration? It makes me a racist? I would say the racists are the people who come into a country that isn't theirs and take it over and tell me I should speak their language. You go to a sporting event and they're waving the Mexican flag, not an American flag? What if my grandfather had waved the Russian flag? They would have killed him. Playboy, you wouldn't be here speaking freely on the radio every day if it weren't for your immigrant grandparents and so many millions more. Savage, not all waves of immigration are the same. Not all immigrants are the same. Not all nations of origin are the same. The times are different. My grandparents wanted to become American. Maybe they spoke their home language at home, but when they went outside, they wanted to be Americans. So I don't know what that has to do with race. I think it has to do with attitude. And by the way, I'm not talking about all immigrants, not even all the illegal immigrants. I'm talking about 30%. I've seen data that one-third of all prisoners in America happen to be illegal aliens, most of them from Mexico. We can't survive as a nation if we keep letting this large swath of people come across the border. There are countries that have put up barriers that say you can come into the country if you have a profession we need or if you have a certain amount of money to start a business. But, and I'm continuing now with the great Playboy interview, but we can't afford to support you. We can't do that here. We say, come on in. Now, how in the world can we take in an unlimited number of people? Who's going to pay for their health care? Who's going to pay for their jail care? Who's going to pay for their legal care? Who's going to pay for their housing? The answer is the rest of us are, and that's why we're going broke. Again, I got to say, I was shocked to see that this guy was sitting there with such hatred towards me because he didn't tell me that. I mean, it'd be one thing if he came and said to me, you know, I really hate your politics or I hate you, and, you know, this is going to be an antagonistic interview and let's go for it. So you get into a wrestling match. But the man pretended he was a nice guy and liked me. Then he goes and writes this crap, saying he hated me the whole time. And then he says, even when we were laughing, I knew he was thinking liberal vermin media. I didn't think it once. I felt as though I had reached, contacted an old friend. I felt very good about the interview. It just shows you how naive I really am. Frankly, I think it says an awful lot about him and the paranoia and the backstabbing nature of this man is amazing to me. And he says my opinions are poison. So my opinions about stopping illegal immigration are poison, even though my opinions represent that of 70, 75% of the American people. Let me ask you something. Whose opinions are really poison? Men like him who want the illegals to run all over us and bankrupt us even further? Michael Savage Playboy interview. So before he writes about the interview, there's a whole page about the article and about me. And then Hochman says these nasty things. He says, most of the time I hated him. I don't think that this writer, whatever his name is, David Hochman, will ever live down what he said in this article. I believe that this man is going to regret that he ever said that he hated me for the rest of his life. I believe that his own mother would find that offensive, frankly. And I don't know of, I've never read, by the way, an interview in my entire life of anyone where the interviewer said most of the time I hated him. I've seen interviews from some mass about mass murderers. I've seen Dan Rather's interview with Saddam Hussein, a noted mass murderer. Did Dan Rather say I hated Saddam Hussein once? I've seen interviews with Ahmadinejad, the Hitler of our time. The man who kills homosexuals, a man who kills women, a man who kills political dissidents. Has anyone ever said I hated him? No, the liberals seem to love him. And yet they hated me. Now, what does that tell you about them? What does that tell you about liberals in the media? So you could say, well, look, you got what you deserve. You knew he was a liberal. Why'd you do it? I'll tell you why I did it. I'll give you two answers. One, because I was treated, I think, roundly and fairly by a real writer who was really more like a poet than a journalist in The New Yorker. I mean, you know, the man who wrote that interview with me last year in The New Yorker was a real writer. And he didn't come into it with a political bias, so far as I know. I'm sure he's a liberal. He was a music critic for The New York Times. But the man understood art, and he understood the difference between mere rhetoric and real art. And that's why he wanted to interview me. He knew I was an artist. This guy doesn't know the difference between an artist, a polemicist, a poet, a pauper, and a shrimp. Moreover, he doesn't understand what he just did by saying most of the time I hated him. He hated me? He didn't know me. He sat with me for 3 hours and he hated me? How could he hate me? What did I do that made him hate me? He hated my ideas, but he didn't know the difference between a man and his ideas? And this just shows you the trouble we are in America. Do you understand this? The second reason I did the interview is because I thought I could reach an entirely new audience, which I'm going to do, because it's a 3D issue of women with, fake boobs, and you've got a lot of people who are going to buy it just to, you know, ooh, look at her boobs, you know, big deal. There's not enough boobs in the world. That's all you need is now plastic boobs and in paper and in a pair of glasses on your head to just show you. But anyway, so it's going to reach a lot of people. They may find out that a lot of people agree with me on illegal immigration. So, you know, I'll go on with the interview in a minute on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. Here is the best from May of 2010 from the Savage Nation. So you want me to continue or not? Raise your hands. I'll read another piece, then take your calls. I am reading from the 8,000-word interview with Michael Savage in Playboy, which is not yet on the stands. I don't know if you want to buy it when you read this. Playboy, what made you leave America to go to Fiji as a young man in 1969? Savage. It made no rational sense at all. But I've looked back and self-analyzed it. Part of it was trying to find cures for my brother, who was born brain damaged. When I was a kid, my mother cried over and over again to me about Jerome, and I'd say, Ma, if God could come down, I'd say this to her when I was a little boy. What would you ask God to do? She would say, I'd ask him to fix your brother, make him better. Now, what does a little boy want to do more than please his mother? I'm going to give Mommy what she wants. There's no God in the room, so I'll help her. I'll fix my brother. So I looked for all these cures in the oddest places because I knew traditional medicine didn't have answers. That's what led me outside the normal medical school thing and on the long journey to Fiji. But what the heck did I know? I'm living there on these godforsaken islands, working with folk healers.
I've left a young wife and children behind. I spent most of my money because nobody would fund it. What the heck was I trying to prove? That I'm Schweitzer? That I'm a wild man? I wouldn't do it again today. Playboy, again, instead of responding to that, he goes on to Allen Ginsberg. Do you regret inviting Allen Ginsberg, the famous beat poet, to visit you there after you and he exchanged a series of letters? And I give him the answer. It's very boring, frankly. And he brings up the naked picture. I may as well answer it again. What remains is a photograph of you swimming naked with Ginsberg, who was sort of the poster child for gay America at the time. Laughs. Savage, have you seen the picture? Playboy, no. Can you show it to us? Savage, I don't have it, but I know the picture. There's me, ethnobotanist, jumping in a cold river. There's Allen Ginsberg. There's another poet. And now open the frame, and there's about 20 other people with us, all naked. But that's how people went swimming in the South Pacific at that time. See, they don't talk about that. Instead, they take the snapshot, cut out the other people, and make it look like I was swimming with that filth. But listen to this, Playboy. But given your stance on gay politics, do you understand why that photograph would be confusing now? Savage, angrily. What does it mean? You hang around with a gay man, you're gay? I mean, what are they, nuts? Don't you see the hate that comes out of people when they try to pervert this? Who the heck would sleep with Ginsberg even if they were gay? He was a horrendous man, horrible, and there were a lot of reasons to not like the man. He wasn't my friend. Now, here's the best part of it. This is really great. Playboy, were you ever confused about your sexuality? No. Hello? What is this? I mean, I can't understand this. Playboy, well, your vitriol towards them makes us think of something a teacher once said. Quote, when we hate others, it's because we recognize something of ourselves in them. Savage, so in other words, I want to be a radical Muslim who blows up people in a schoolyard? Do you understand the answer I gave him, how brilliant it is, and how illogical this guy is? Do you understand what I just did here? Savage, I go on and I say, I hate radical Islam because I hate radical Islam, not because I want to put a bomb in a schoolyard. That's the logic of what you just said. And again, you're assuming I hate gays. I don't hate gays. I've said 100 times I'm a sexual libertarian. It goes back to the same lie. You're coming at it from the wrong perspective. I've said it. I'll say it again. I hope the interview is about more than this. I really do. This obsession, I don't understand. You're a sex magazine? Okay. So you want to know about sex. As I said before, I'm a sexual libertarian. Playboy, when did you lose your virginity? Savage, oh God, how old was I? 19, 18, I don't remember. But I did date a Playboy bunny when I was 17 or 18. Playboy, you did? Savage, yes. I was in college, and I'll continue about that little story in a minute here because I know that you're going to want to hear about it. Play a little Desafinado because that was the music that was playing when this occurred. Stan Getz music I'll never forget as long as I live because that was the music that played. Well, it's been no big deal. By today's standards, big deal. Like a waitress in IHOP with a bunny tail. I mean, that's about it. I'm nothing against waitresses or IHOP. You know what I'm saying? But everybody, how could that woman be better than any woman you've ever seen on the planet? Why? Because she had a fake bunny tail on? She was suddenly the greatest woman on earth? All right. So that's not in the interview. That's on the radio. I'm taking a breather. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm surprised. I still don't hate the guy. I'm surprised he would write a thing that he hated me because it makes him look bad. You know, and I'm going to confide in you something funny. He wants to get it on the straight up of the MS. At the end, he wanted to take a cell phone picture of me on my boat. I said, why do you want to do that? He said, my mother's a big fan. I said, oh, God. I can tell you right now, if his mother's a big fan and she hears what he said about me, she's not going to be a happy camper the next time she sees little Davy boy. I think mommy's going to give it to him pretty good. And if Mama Hockman, if you're listening to this show somewhere in America and you want to apologize for the boy you raised for being such a lout and a coward, you can call 1-800-449-8255. You can get even with your son, honey. All right, we'll be back for more of the famous Playboy interview with me, Michael Savage, on the redistribution of reality right here on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
San Francisco, Cal, you're on the Savage Nation.
Doctor, the reason why your devoted listeners are interested in what you had for dinner the evening before the show is simply because, well, let's face it, you never have a dull moment in a restaurant. It's either public or
Well, no, wait a minute. That's not true. I do eat, and nothing happens other than I eat.
Oh, but it's always about either some nasty, mean-looking cook with a cigarette out one side of his mouth staring at you weird, and that's when the food is great. But when everybody's nice and everything's just right, the food is always terrible. So, you know, it's akin to a lot of what of us who frequent hospitality establishments also experience, particularly in the Bay Area. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, yes. It's very difficult, except for the few restaurants I go to, and I know when to go. I avoid weekends, you know, for sure. You want to have a good meal, go on Monday night.
You get the place to yourself, huh?
You got the place to yourself, and the food is usually purchased Monday morning. Everybody knows that in the restaurant business. Monday night, Tuesday night's nice. But that's not what most... I mean, most people work. They don't have the time to go to dinner on Monday or Tuesday night. So when you go out in San Francisco, Cal, do you find people rude? Do you find the waiters hostile or what?
Most of the time, San Francisco, for as popular as the tourist trade that they claim to have, service is pretty... For the most part, it's pretty low rated. I give it a very low mark, a D minus all the way around, especially out here in Marin County where both of us live.
Oh, my God. Don't get me started on Marin County. It's why I really only eat in San Francisco and in the two places I mentioned, the two kings of Italian, the Aliotto's and North Beach. Because, they know me, so they treat me well. That is absolutely true. But they're nice people. They're genuinely nice people. You know what I found in restaurants? Unless there's a patron at the door, I won't go in there. I don't care where I am in the country. There has to be like an owner or let's say a first-class manager who is a de facto representative of the owner who makes you feel at home and welcomes you, or else the food, to me, is never right. There has to be someone who really cares about what they're serving and watches like a hawk. You know what restaurants are like. If they start to ignore every plate has to be looked at or they will slide very rapidly. Don't you think, Cal?
Well, now, every rule has an exception, though, because I took to heart the story you told about the Chinese place. I'm thinking it might be the same place I went, where you go to, it's just a family, and they look at you like you don't belong there, and they hate you, and they'll serve you because they have to.
You don't mean out in the avenues where it looks like Pol Pot's brother is the owner, right?
Yes. If you sit kindly...
Yeah, he sits behind the counter. He glowers at you. I feel like in a movie set for like a Vietnam-era movie of like a prison camp. And he's the guard up in the tower staring down with hate. That's the restaurant, that one?
That's the one. If he's promised to sit in the corner and not make any noise and don't order anything that's...
Now, wait a minute. You don't mean... I'm not going to specify. You don't mean on Geary Street, do you?
Of course, yes.
Yes. Now, I mean, the food used to be great, but they have a new trick. Whatever you order, they bring the rice after the food. You're eating the food and there's no rice. Every time it's the same thing. You have to say, where's the rice? Like they never heard about rice coming with the food? Have you noticed that little gimmick?
I didn't. I'll be paying attention for sure next time.
Oh, you mean you get rice with your food from Pol Pot? How did you arrange that?
All I know is I just feel lucky. I get in and out of there and eat without getting hurt.
Well, one of the things I don't like, I used to love it because the food was really the best. The clay pot cookery was the best, but they got so arrogant. They got lazy. You know, they start raking it in and the white people all bow when they go in. It's mainly the university crowd from UC Med Center. Every one of them bows, yeah, going to have a glass of water. Oh, thank you. 80 times thank you for a glass of water and a napkin. I mean, after 10 years of that, what you start doing is you spit at the people who come in. You look down at them like they're morons. What are they thanking the owner for? He's in business to serve you a glass of water and a napkin.
We got to know, did Teddy freak out when you showed him a picture of the labradoodle?
The labradoodle. No, there's a neighbor's labradoodle that barks at Teddy. But Teddy is a very well-balanced, good-natured little boy, and he doesn't bark back. He looks at him like he's crazy. He figures it's a product of bad breeding. Real poodles don't snarl. Real poodles don't snarl. They just lift their heads and walk away. Oh, I've had a lot of fun so far today. Why? Why is this man laughing? Because if you stop laughing, you're a dead man. You're a dead man already. So for lunch, I'm walking around my favorite neighborhood. I walk up Broadway, past the strip clubs. I look in one store after the other. There's the Afghani restaurant. That's a joke unto itself. Everything, I have a comment in my head. I pass the tattoo parlor, comment in my head. I look in, tattoo, comment. Next, I pass the Afghani restaurant out of business as we move to. I said, where would you move to? A bomb making? They move to another. I never went to an Afghani restaurant. Why do I want to eat like old lamb? Whatever. I can roll them up in a carpet. Next stop, bad pizza. The worst pizza in America is on Broadway. I don't know what it's a front for. I would never eat pizza. It looks like yellow with mice in it. Next, you walk up the street. You come to the hostel, and you see the Eurotrash. The superb creatures from Europe. Remember the Eurotrash was a popular word you were allowed to use for a while, a phrase? That went out of now it's like a Merotrash. According to Obama, we're a Merotrash, and the Euros are the hero. How did it become that the Europeans are like something to look up to? Where'd that come from? I mean, individually, they're going to be nice, nasty, but what do you mean Europeans? What's that all about? Their culture? Just take a look at some of the Europeans outside the hostel. You'll see what culture is. You never saw such misshapen people with knapsacks in your life. Who would go to a hostel? I don't understand that in this day and age. You're either going to get raped or you're going to get herpes or AIDS laying in there. What are you going in there for? You're better off in a state-controlled flop house than a hostel. A girl alone with a knapsack from Denmark in a hostel in San Francisco? A rape job or a herpes? One or the other? What is she doing here, I ask myself. What are they looking for? You look at these kids, some of them are like 40-year-old pervs, you know, they're still in the hospitals figuring they're going to get lucky with someone from Denmark. And maybe they do, I don't know, they travel the world, I don't know what they're looking for, but you look at a kid, 20, 25, they're traveling. All right, I did it. So what are they looking for? They're looking for a romance? I don't know, or they're looking for adventure? What adventure? What adventure can you have in the modern world other than getting mugged or raped? What adventures lie out there anymore in this homogenized world where you go to China and they look like the people from Brooklyn? Or you go to Russia, they look like the people from San Francisco. Everyone's wearing the same garbage clothing. No pressed pants, T-shirts. Everyone looks disheveled. Everyone looks disheveled. No one looks right. What is the point? I'm asking myself. In other words, let's go back to, all right, you start to sound cranky. All right, so I'm cranky. So let's go back to when I traveled. What was I looking for? Adventure and romance, and I found both. But then I realized that travel unto itself is a bore and a waste of time. Travel for travel's sake has to be about the most boring waste of energy known to mankind. So I decided that I had to do something useful if I ever were going to travel again, because I've always hated travel. I'm a homebody, right? So I spent many years going to the most exotic islands on Earth to collect medicinal plants, and I did very good scientific research. But it was travel with a meaning. Otherwise, I never would have been there. I hated the place, actually. At a certain point, you come to realize it's just foreign. It doesn't mean it's better. So where am I going with this? I haven't any idea. Any more than a modern artist has any idea why he painted a picture of a broken society. So I've just painted a picture for you. If you want to talk about art, you want to talk about science, you want to talk about Danish women in hostels. So then I continue on my walk up Broadway. And I decide, no, I'm not going to go to North Beach and have a big Italian meal. It's lunchtime. I got to do a show. I can't fill my guts with pasta and sauce and talk to anybody. I don't want to talk to anybody. So I decided to have a power lunch in the cheapest Chinese joint that I know on Broadway, where they throw the food at you and they're hostile. They look like a combination of a Pol Pot and Ho Chi Minh in this restaurant. Really nasty, particularly to Caucasians. Nasty and mean. But I like the place. I've been eating there for 20 years. They still don't know me. It's an amazing fact. I mean, I guess all white men look alike. They know me. I go 20 years I've been in and out of the place. Anyway, I get the lunch plate. I can't believe they can still turn out a meal like this for like $5. I had the calamari and rice. The rice was horrendous. I never even had bad rice in my life till today. I don't know how rice can be bad. It was horrible rice. Disgusting. Maybe I'm into a day of self-abuse. I enjoyed every bite of the calamari. I loved it. I felt like the revolution had come. I was poor, totally poor again, and eating in the same places I ate in 30 years ago. And guess what? Nothing ever went wrong in these slop joints. And then, here's the interesting part. So you walk through Chinatown in San Francisco, and I go next door. I mean, I told you, the minute I eat, I'm looking for the next meal. I look in the next place, a dim sum place. All local Chinese. I can't believe it. three pieces of shrimp dumplings for like $1.60. Then I go to the next joint and it's full, and lunch plates are like $2.95, $3. You know, like pork guts over rye. I don't know what's in it. Chicken fangu, chicken egg young. I don't know what. Whatever they threw together over rice, $3. Now, when I was young, I used to eat here all the time in these places. I took the kids here all the time. They grew up on cheap peasant food. And to this day, we all still love the same cheap peasant food. So what is that telling you? It's telling you something. It's telling you nothing. It's telling you that the man talking to you can ride on a donkey or he can ride in the limo. I can fly Southwest or I can fly in a private jet. It's all the same to me. I'm indifferent to it all. Could you play a little of the other jazz here on the Savage Nation? We'll take a quick break together. You got any of the Take Five stuff? None. Okay. Don't you have the new stuff? Must we go back again? Can you give me a piece of new stuff? You know, I have a pain in my arm that I had to get an EKG. Luckily, it wasn't a heart attack. There's a pinched nerve in my neck. Why a pinched nerve in my neck? I've been healthy all my life. Why now? Stress. Finished the book. Playboy article. Personal problems. S happens to people. Here today, gone tomorrow. I know someone who had to go to a high school today for grief counseling. A 16-year-old died of a heart attack at the desk, not even playing sports. Then I know someone at the grief counseling at the CHP. Our heart goes out to the family. A motorcycle cop with much experience cut off by a dumb old woman. Hit the car. His arm is hanging. His life is hanging. He's hanging. You're hanging. We're hanging. All aboard. I'll be back.
Savage.
When this song came out, I think I was in high school with a crew cut. I don't know what. Play it louder. I want to remember. I want a reminiscence. 59 Chevy, maybe. Yeah, like around there. One of the guys I knew, I told you, became a famous rock and roll singer for 2 years. We were schlepping to high school, college. He was in Japan. He was 16 years old. Huge rock and roll hit. We were so jealous. Came back, had a Jaguar, like a 21-year-old girlfriend. Eventually, though, you know, he flashed out and he went to work for the post office in Woodstock, New York. There's nothing wrong with being a postman. No, I'm serious. You know, if you get it young, you usually don't have it your whole life. It's guys like me who struggled for 40 years who finally, you know, can enjoy the fruits of their success. You know, did you ever think about that? Would you rather have it young? What if God gave you a choice? You can't have it your whole life, okay? You're either going to struggle your whole life and have it when you're older, okay? Or you're going to have a tremendous burst of success when you're young, and then in middle age, you're going to basically have nothing. I mean, which one would you take? You know that you would go for the first one if you were young. Because you don't think tomorrow's ever coming, right? Now, what does it have to do with politics? I think Obama's very much like that adolescent. He doesn't understand that he has squandered his youth with this socialism. He cannot push anything forward ever again. He has been found out, discovered. The mask has been taken off. His extraordinary expenditures are being exemplified with this grotesque trip to India. If the man had truly been humbled by this election, as he claims he has been, chastened in some way, he hasn't. What he would do is say, you know, in light of the fact that I realize most Americans don't like this government spending, I'm canceling this trip to India because it was going to cost $200 million a day, and I really don't think we need a junket to India, and I'm not taking 3,000 people in warships. I'm canceling it. His popularity would soar, but he won't do that because he still has hubris. He still has hubris. The man still thinks he's, you know, above it all. And that's it. Maybe that's good for all of us. So as I say, this friend of mine, I mean, that song reminded me of that. That's how I got back to politics. When you are as political as I am, everything is political. I don't care if it's a bad Indian meal or a good Italian meal. I've been up all night, I swear to God. It's one of those weird nights where I thought I couldn't even go on the air today. I got mad. You know, I did a show at 7 in the morning, which for me is frightening. then another at 10, then 11. I'm not used to this. Then the Indian buffet, and I went back to sleep and couldn't sleep. And here it is. I have more energy than ever. The thing is, though, is that you know when you're not functioning perfectly is when your memory starts to jump. And right now, truly, it's not like I have any trouble with memory. I never do. But because of the exhaustion of the last 6, 7, 8, 10 weeks of the book and the election, my mind is a little on the memory side. I could just feel it's not firing as fast as it normally does, where I can make up jokes on the spot, create beautiful ideas, paint pictures with my words, incredible energy, and also have a great memory for almost all the facts and figures I want to remember. I really found it lacking just for 1 second. You'll have to forgive me. I don't know what my name is, nor do I know why I'm standing here with a microphone in my hand. Where am I, guys? Where exactly? What are we doing here? Right. Daisy, Daisy. Daisy, Daisy. My name is Hal. You remember that? That was one of the most startling scenes in the history of the movie. Do you remember that? Kubrick's 2000 and, was it 2001? Imagine how long ago that was. 2001. That was interesting. Wait a minute. Didn't we get hit on 9/11? But like 2001, right? Yeah, it was interesting. Anyway, but I remember when I first saw that movie, like 1970, I saw it in the Cinerama Theater in Honolulu. I couldn't believe that movie. You know that movie, 2001, when I saw it, I actually worked for my PhD because of that movie. I realized that he was projecting a future where all of the people who ran the world all had higher degrees. Do you know that? Of course, he wasn't correct. Take a look at who's on Fox News, symbol shot. But having said that, the fact is, the movie was quite influential. But do you remember when the HAL 2000, when he gets into the computer's brain and starts taking apart the memory chips, and the computer talks to him? It was so eerie. It was so eerie. You know what I'm saying? The idea of your brain melting down like that was terrifying.
I honestly think you ought to sit down calmly, take a stress pill, and think things over.
Daisy. Daisy. Give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy. All for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a marriage.
You're listening to the sound of the Treasury Secretary as he prints more money. He has no idea what he is doing or what he's printing. That sounds like the sound of the Obama administration, actually. It sounds like it's, doesn't it? I mean, the overall administration sounds like that when you think about it. Houston, Texas. Pete, you're on the Savage Nation.
Well, sir, I just want to give you a quick Tup story. Took your advice, took my copy of Tup into the polling place, and had it tucked neatly under my arm. After the first few looks and sneers that I got from a few people in the line, I proceeded to open it up to your Obamacare chapter, where I'd left off, page 221. And as I was reading it in line, I had the sensation of someone behind me with the combination of halitosis and garlic rolling over my left shoulder. As I moved up a few feet in the line and started to turn around, I noticed this older gentleman was none other than a independent school district police officer.
So he was looking at the book?
He was looking at the book over my shoulder.
So the policeman had garlic breath while he was reading my book over your shoulder?
Yeah, he must have hit the pizza parlor before he showed up to throw his vote in.
But did he like the book, or he was winking because he liked it or didn't like it?
I got the impression he liked it.
Be on the lookout for a policeman. How tall was he? A policeman in uniform, 5'10", with garlic breath.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show,
the Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best from May of 2010. I'm going to make a commitment today on the Savage Nation to avoid anything that is within the alimentary canal from the front to the end. We will nothing to do with anything to do with the alimentary canal for the moment. I'm going to talk about cars, classic cars. I went to a classic car show. I'm more or less a recluse, as you well know. I pride myself on reclusiveness. Now, there are younger guys who are hungry, and they need to make a buck, and they're everywhere. They're the Zelligs of the media. Wherever you turn, there they are. This Tea Party, that Tea Party. It's important stuff. Everywhere you turn, Fox News, CNN, Bill Markowitz's show, everywhere you turn, there are Zelligs in the media appearing every day in every way. Now, that's fine. I don't do it. I never like to do it, and I don't want to do it. So I basically stay in my house in pajamas, except for the occasional bicycle ride or the occasional car show or the miserable trip to a restaurant, which I always regret. Now, there's a secondary note to all of this talking here on the Savage Nation. I stayed in bed most of the weekend, and I feel great. My mind feels better. I feel calmer. I can think. So I went to a car show. The Marin Sonoma Classic Car Show out in the Marin, where was it? An outdoor thing. And I was astounded at the love for vehicles that I saw there, including my own. I mean, I can remember the cars that were there. Some of them, the Duesenbergs, the 59 Vet, the Mercedes-Benz 300 SLs, the Bentley Continental from 1961, the Pierce Arrows, the 56 Continental, the 56 T-Bird. I mean, see, if I just mention the names of these cars to most of you, they actually symbolize to you various images come to your mind. And if I say to you, I saw the most amazingly beautiful 1957 Chrysler 300D, and I couldn't take my eyes off it, you'll understand what I'm saying. But, you know, it's funny. Of all the cars I saw there, I had a friend I ran into, an old mechanic friend of mine. He used to fix my old Jaguars, which always broke down. He took a picture of me in front of one car. I only asked him to take a picture of me and Teddy in front of one car. It was a Model T Ford Roadster. It was so beautiful. And I wanted to picture myself in front of the Model T only because I used to build them out of plastic when I was a kid. And it just reminded me. I remember the hard rubber wheels. It all came back to me. But what I'm getting at was the crowd at the auto show. And I was thinking about a few things as I walked around looking at these stunningly gorgeous cars. I could not get out of my head, what would the Obamaites be thinking? That's all I was thinking. What would these hardcore leftist freaks in the White House think of a classic car show such as the one I went to over the weekend? And all I could think about was these mean monsters from Harvard, these undereducated pinheads, would sort of not only look down upon classic car show such as this, but that in the future they might ban this sort of show because the cars were not green enough, or that only people with money could afford cars like this. And I started thinking as I walked around looking at these incredible classic cars, what do you think it is about car shows that angers progressives? And then I was going to ask you, do you still have a love affair with cars, or are they just box transportation to you? And then I was going to say, what does the way a person takes care of their car say about their politics? And do liberals drive differently than conservatives? I can say for sure. Genuinely, when I'm cut off, it's a lame brain with an Obama bumper sticker from the right lane. One after the other, and it's usually older women who have been disappointed in life. Either their husbands left them or they were never married, or whatever it is. They generally still drive around with the Obama, you know, for president bumper sticker in some kind of econo box, and they usually try to cut you off in the right lane, and when you don't let them in, they get furious. Like, we have merging lanes in certain parts of the area where I live. Inevitably, they know the right lane merges into the left, they know it's coming to a dead end, and it's always the, quote, nice liberals who try to speed up in the right lane,
And I don't know. I won't let him in. I won't let him in. I'm a very competitive person. I don't like being cut off. So I give Wilhelm the gas, and Wilhelm gives them the fume. And they get cut off to the, you know, like, screw you. I mean, what do you mean? You're going to cut me off because you're a nice person? Because you have an Obama bumper sticker? So I, anyway, so the cars. You know, you want to talk about cars. I don't know if you want to talk about it. You want me to get into the whole politics today? Obama signs a Freedom of Press Act and takes no questions from the press. Hello? That is why I'd rather talk about Janis Joplin's psychedelic-themed 1965 Porsche 356 Cabriolet. I have never been a Porsche fan. I never owned one. I never wanted to own one. I was never, I don't know what it is, maybe the Nazi thing. I don't really know. It can't be the Nazi thing because I own a Mercedes, and that was so long ago, who cares anyway? I mean, I love Mercedes-Benz. It's the best car I ever owned in my life. It's all I drive. I told you I have fancy cars, and I have unfancy cars. My daily driver is a 600S, an S600 Mercedes. I gave it a name, Wilhelm. I don't drive around saying Wilhelm. I don't talk to it. I'm generally either driving or talking to my dog, Teddy. But the fact of the matter is, after I got this car, I never, ever needed a sports-type car. And I do own a Ferrari, a 430. I rarely, if ever, drive it. But the funny thing is that after I saw the Testarossa and the other Ferraris at the fairgrounds yesterday, actually, even though it was cloudy and horrible and miserable weather, I went all the way to a garage where I keep it, took the cover off it, and took the Ferrari for a drive because the color itself, the Ferrari red in the gray, was astoundingly beautiful. But I'm not one of these guys with the top down making believe I'm enjoying the sun. I don't know. I still don't understand that part of it. Do you? I can't understand it. Whenever there's a hot, sunny day, you see people with the top down. They're enjoying the sun. And I ask myself, did they go to the fifth grade? Did they don't understand the relationship between the sun and skin cancer, especially amongst white men over the age of 13? I mean, what are they thinking? A convertible's nice for a night, a warm, balmy night in Miami, but not for the day. What do you need sun on your face for? It's to show off. That's all it is. Now, who in this day and age thinks anyone who drives around in a convertible is rich or a celebrity? Does anyone, can you answer that question? Most of the so-called loser celebrities in Hollywood drive Priuses anyway. I know that for a fact because I go to L.A. an awful lot. They wouldn't be seen dead in a new car other than some kind of hybrid, you know, hybrid. All the lowbrows are in hybrids. I love that one. But that's it. I mean, there's a lot to be said for a Rolls Royce. A Rolls Royce? In this economy? Yeah. Hello, yes, if a man earned the money and he bought a Rolls Royce and he loves the Rolls Royce, who are you to tell him he can't drive the Rolls Royce? He's paid a gas guzzler tax. That's not enough, though, for Cass Sunstein from Harvard, whose father taught him over a seltzer and corned beef how to take over the world with lies, in my humble opinion. I'm so sick of these communists, you have no idea. That's why I don't want to talk about them. I don't want to even dignify these communists from Harvard, these losers who have never created a product or a service that anybody wants. I have a pattern. It's a struggle sometimes, but truthfully, by the time I get on the air, I actually love it, and I sail through the hours on the radio, and it gives me great relief to be able to be doing something very useful, pointing out the hateful administration that we have. And I was saying, do people still say to a little child, what do you want to be when you grow up? Because when I was a kid, that was a major league question. The uncles, the father's friends, they leaned down. I couldn't have been four. What do you want to be when you grow up? They start with me when I was three. The work ethic has to be, you know, instilled in a child. It doesn't come out of the air. It doesn't come by spontaneous combustion, so to speak. You don't get it out of the air. A child has to be taught that work is beautiful, that work is essential, that work is the essence of living. Now, if you are in La Greek, where leisure is the essence of living, then we have nothing to talk about. The Greek society is very interesting. I mean, it's probably part of my background. But the Hellenists were fundamentally leisure-oriented. They were oriented towards beauty. There's nothing wrong with leisure or beauty. I understand that. But as a be-all and an end-all of existence, it's not enough for me. As a side job, fine. I mean, you can be a worker and still love beauty. You can pursue beauty. You can see beauty. You can steep yourself in beautiful music and beautiful art and beautiful poetry and beautiful flowers, if you wish, as I do. But the fact of the matter is to devote your whole life to beauty is, to me, already on the other side of the coin. So let me get back to the kids. So they say to a kid, what do you want to be when you grow up? So kids start out with, I want to be an astronaut. There was a time that a kid would say that. Or I want to be a baseball star. I want to be like, pick your favorite baseball star. Or I want to be like a football star, whoever. Now, I don't know what kids would say today, but you look at the role models that the vermin in the media hold up every day, each and every day. Who are the role models for our children today? It's one drug addict, one deviant, one anti-American slime ball after another. I don't even know who a kid holds up as a role model anymore. But I really don't think that there was a kid somewhere in Indonesia, you know, 40-odd years ago who said, when I grow up, I want to be the first Leninist president of the United States of America. I don't really believe that. People would say, I want to be the president of the United States of America. That I understand. I mean, I never said that. I never thought that that was possible.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. Here is the best from May of 2010 from the Savage Nation. At a Greek wedding not two, 3 weeks ago. Sort of a Greek wedding. The groom threw a dish. They ran out of the kitchen. I thought they were going to draw guns and call a black helicopter. Everything with real passion is, everything's got to be, you know, written. They didn't know what to do. A guy threw a dish. Did you ever drink that Greek stuff? I once went to a Greek, I'm going to drift off a little. I'm so bored of it all. Really care about Greece. What do I know with Greece? England, what do I have control over it? At a certain point, there's a Greek liquor that they make. I got so drunk on that stuff, I never touched that poison again. It's made from pine sap. I'm sure it's filled with pycnogenol, and it's probably why they could live to 115 drinking it. I don't know. But the stuff is psychedelic in its alcoholic effects. Not just alcohol. I mean, this, what's it called, that stuff? Does anyone know? You know, ouzo, right? Ouzo? Is it called ouzo? Is that a rice? I don't know. I think it's ouzo. I was at a Greek festival in Marin County, California once, years ago, and I drank that stuff. And you get like this lateral stoner feeling where everything is like projected further from you than it is, you know? Anywho, here we are in the Savage Nation. On the way home from the studio last night, I stopped into an Italian restaurant for some Italian bread I like to bring home before I went home for dinner. And I saw a slew of middle-aged people in there at the bar watching television. White middle-class people. I didn't know what they were looking at because I don't know. It was like I was an observer from another planet. So I get the seated bread. I pay a few bucks for it, say hello to one of the waiters. I look up and they cheer. They break out in cheers. Yay! And some goon with a basketball threw it somewhere. I ran out muttering to myself as though I was from another planet. After a day like this with Obama giving that performance, they're worried about basketball. Now you understand why we have Obama as the maximum leader. Yep, we've gone from hope and change to dope and strange in 18 months. That's right, from hope and change to dope and strange in only 18 months. But we're talking now about cars and boats and planes and how much I love machines and how I went to the classic car show. I mean, I'm going to go to the Impressionist exhibit at the museum and come back and talk about a little bit about Impressionist paintings. Another one of my, well, former loves, just as cars were. I don't go to car shows, but I did, and I realized what I'm missing. And it takes a lot of work to keep these cars, you know, looking so beautiful, I guess. They truck them there, a lot of them. I was amazed that they sat in the hot sun, and they let them sit without tenting them. I was quite surprised, you know, that kind of thing. So why do liberals hate classic cars is an interesting question. All I could think about as I walked around the fairgrounds looking at the beautiful cars was liberals and why they would love to ban this sort of gathering and how they'd like to turn these cars into, you know, recycle them into sort of, I don't know, homeless shelters or something. I couldn't believe it's like two different universes, you know. Caterpillar C18 diesels, unbelievable engines. Unbelievable engines. And my boat just gets up and, you know, you got this 40-ton boat.
You're doing 8 knots, 7 knots, 9 knots. You get her out through the Raccoon Straits, and you're heading out toward the bridge. If there are no pesky sailors or pesky the sailboats, I can dodge. At least I could see them. But the schmucks on the kayaks, I can't stand. They're as stupid as bicyclists on country roads. What do they have in their heads, these morons in kayaks? You're going out in a kayak in an open waterway, and there are boats, and we're supposed to see you in a turbulent bay, and you won't put a flag on the back of your schmuck kayak, your Nanook of the sea? How did you get your schmuck kayak to the water, I like to ask the putts. You put it on your stupid SUV and brought it there, idiot. But all of a sudden, you missed the purity. Now, I don't mind if a guy kayaks, but keep it to the side of the damn bay, or put a flag on the back of your thing so no one runs you over. So I go out, and I see the bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, and I want to head out to the sea. So I open the engines up. That boat jumps 40 tons. If I slam the throttles forward, I don't slam them. I push them forward. I don't like stressing an engine any more than I stress myself. I grade up fast, though, and I go to, let's say, I don't know, 2,200 RPM, and you'll see this boat move from 8 knots to 20 knots, 22 knots, like a fast speedboat. Think of it, 40 tons, and it'll move like that. Yes, the fuel consumption's enormous. A Cat C-18, which runs about 1,000 horsepower each, you got 2,000 horsepower. When you're running at 2,300 RPM, you're burning about 52 gallons an hour on each engine. So let's say 100 gallons an hour on the boat. So that's your business? Who's paying for it, schmuck? You? I'm paying for it. You know how much of that is tax? A lot of it. If I want to burn 100 gallons an hour, that's my business. It's not your business. It's my business. That's how I see it. I work with the best team in talk radio. They know me. They're like my friends, all the guys in the back room. It's unbelievable to me. This is a family. This is a team. We are the Yankees of talk radio.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Look, I'm not going to let the story of Lieutenant Michael Behenna be covered up by the mainstream media. A great injustice was done to this outstanding soldier who is being punished for doing his job and saving lives. He's rotting in a cell in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Joining us now is Vicki Behenna, his mother, to give us a new update on what's going on. Mrs. Behenna, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, thank you for having me on again.
For the listeners who may have missed this important story, please give us a reminder on what's going on with your son.
My son, Michael, was a first lieutenant in the United States Army serving a tour in a combat zone in Iraq. His platoon was hit by an IED in April of 2008. After that attack, and the attack killed two of his soldiers, two Iraqis that were traveling with him, and seriously injured the platoon sergeant and company medic. After that attack, Michael read a military intelligence report that Ali Mansour was a member of an Al-Qaeda cell and that the Al-Qaeda cell was responsible for the attack. After Michael read Mansour's name, the platoon did exactly what they were supposed to do and they went out and detained Mansour to bring him in for questioning about the attack and the Al-Qaeda cell. Mansour stayed in custody for about 10 days, and after that time, Michael was told that Mansour was being released, and Michael was ordered to take him home. Michael asked his commanders, please, you know, do another interrogation and find out more about this Al-Qaeda cell. And they said it didn't really matter what Mansour said, that he had been ordered release and that Michael was to take him home. So Michael took it upon himself to do an interrogation. When he did that, Mansour, who was seated on a rock during the interrogation, stood at one point in time and tried to reach for Michael's gun. Michael shot him in self-defense. He was brought up on charges for premeditated murder. During Michael's trial, we didn't know it at the time until after Michael was convicted of unpremeditated murder, but what we learned subsequent to that is that the government prosecutors, the military prosecutors, had an expert forensic scientist who explained to them that their theory was wrong and that Michael, more likely than not, did act in self-defense. That evidence was withheld. It wasn't turned over to the defense lawyers. Michael was convicted, as I said, of unpremeditated murder and sentenced originally to 25 years. the general, General Townsend at the 101st Airborne Division reduced Michael's sentence to 20 years. And then the Army Clemency and Parole Board just recently reduced Michael's sentence from 20 years to 15.
Well, what's happening now?
Michael's defense lawyer, Mr. Jack Zimmerman, has filed an appeal on Michael's behalf. The appeal addresses the Brady violation, and that is where the prosecutors did not turn over evidence that was favorable to the defense. And so that issue is on appeal. There are some other issues that are raised in that brief as well. We're hoping that the government will respond to the brief fairly quickly. It's my understanding that the Army Court of Appeals is very liberal in its extensions, but because Michael's sitting in prison, I'm hoping that they'll respond more quickly than they normally would. But after it's briefed up, that's what we call it when all the briefs are filed, it'll be set for oral argument in Washington, D.C., and then a decision will be reached by the appellate court. We're, of course, hoping and praying that the appellate court will realize that a grave injustice occurred during Michael's trial, and they will remand the case or send it back, reverse the conviction and send it back for a new trial.
How is Michael holding up?
Michael does extremely well under the circumstances. When he first made it to Fort Leavenworth in the prison, I was, as you can imagine, very concerned about his mental health and how he would deal with such limited restrictions on his freedom and being with people. I mean, these are all nice people that are in this facility, and I was curious about and concerned about how he would deal with that. But Michael told me initially that he was an Army Ranger, and Rangers adapt and overcome, and so that's what he's been doing.
I know many of my listeners have been sending letters. Is Michael receiving these?
Yes, Michael has been receiving a tremendous amount of letters from your supporters, and it is inspiring him and encouraging in him and helping him feel that there is hope at the end of this very dark tunnel. He can receive letters by snail mail. He doesn't have access to a computer, so there are no emails, nothing like that, text messages or anything like that. He can just receive letters from people, and is most, most grateful for the response from your listeners.
Has Michael's story received any other coverage from the mainstream media?
One of the things that's been very disappointing to me is the fact that the national media has not picked up Michael's story. I don't have contacts in the national press, and so the only way that we could contact people, at Fox News or Good Morning America or the Today Show was to send emails to people and let them know about Michael's story. They have not picked up the story as of yet, although I'm still hopeful at some point in time people will pick up Michael's story. I think it's important for the public to understand the dangers our soldiers face in a combat zone and then how they're second-guessed and how when a miscarriage of justice occurs, what happens and how that affects an individual and the family. And so I think it's an important story, but so far the national media has not picked it up. So I appreciate everything that you're doing keeping Michael's story alive.
Well, where does it go from here?
You know, what has been, what we're hoping for right now, and I pray for it every night, is that the appellate court will realize that a grave injustice occurred and that they will reverse this conviction. The law is on Michael's side. And when I say the law, I'm talking about Supreme Court precedent. So the law is on his side, and the facts are on his side. This evidence that the prosecutors had in their hand and in their possession, that their forensic evidence disagreed with their theory of how the shooting occurred, should have been turned over. Michael's testimony was supported by the forensic evidence. That should have been turned over. And it wasn't. So we're very hopeful, and as I said, pray every night that the appellate court sees it the way we do. The only thing that we have ever asked the Army to do, even early on while this was still pending in the trial court, was to grant Michael a new trial where the jury could hear all the evidence. And if the jury still felt that Michael didn't act in self-defense, and they still believe that he executed him in the head like the prosecutors argued that he did, I will be brokenhearted again. But at least as a person who has practiced in the criminal law area my entire life, I'll feel like the jury had all the facts they needed to reach their decision. Right now, the jury was not given all the facts. And so you just can't help but believe, had the jury heard that not just the defense forensic experts agreed Michael was acting in self-defense, but also the government prosecutor's own expert believed Michael was acting in self-defense, that it would have exonerated him. So we're hopeful that the appellate court reaches that decision as well.
What else can my listeners do to help?
One of the things that we have asked individuals to do, of course, is to write the letter to Michael, because it helps him tremendously, but to also contact their senators and congressmen and the Secretary of Defense to let them know that the prosecutions of soldiers who are trying to defend themselves in a combat zone, we just, as an American public, won't allow to happen, particularly as it happened in Michael's case. So I would appreciate it if everybody could just write a letter saying that we are aware of what's happening to these soldiers, this soldier in particular, and we cannot abide by the way that he was prosecuted and evidence withheld in his case.
Vicki Behenna, thanks again for being on my show.
I appreciate everything that you're doing for Michael, and thank you for having me share Michael's story again.
Folks, please go to my website, michaelsavage.com, and contribute what you can for Lieutenant Behenna. I have sent a check of $10,000 from you to the fund, to his fund. If you can't send any money, write a letter to Lieutenant Behenna. Write a letter to Congress. It's each and every one of us can make a difference.
Savage.
I am syndicated by an independent syndicator who is not in any sense a major corporation. Maybe he will be one day. Maybe he knows them. But you see, Limbaugh and Beck are part of corporate talk. And whether you believe it or not, it doesn't really matter whether the corporate talk is left or right. There is a club. And corporate talk only talks about others within the corporate talk fraternity. And so although Michael Savage has been actually banned in Britain, although Michael Savage is actually the first victim of McCarthyism in this period, although Michael Savage is actually the first victim of such things, that didn't matter to Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. What's important is what might happen to Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh, not what actually did happen to Michael Savage. And that's the beauty of it. The beauty is that they can get away with it because the people themselves don't even see the hypocrisy. And now you understand what corporate broadcasting is as opposed to independent broadcasting. All right, let's move on. Now, if you think that I hate San Francisco, you're mistaken. I love San Francisco. I love the city. I love the people who built it. I love the memory of those who built it. I love the foresight of some previous administrations who gave us the beauty that we have in the city. But I got to tell you, there's nothing to beat a night in San Francisco after the show. I went and walked down around the ferries and the tourist ferries. I looked at the paddle wheelers. And I'm thinking of having a big, I'm a man in love with the bay and the sea. I got to tell you, you know that I love boating. So after the show, I was alone walking around there by myself on the waterfront. And I look at the paddle wheelers and I think, you know what? I think I'm going to have another pre-election eve giant 2,000, 3,000 person at sea rally. You know, sort of a paddle wheeler at sea. I don't know when my book comes out, whatever. And I got all excited about it. I made some calls. I made my way over to Alioto's for a couple of drinks. They were stiff ones, real stiff ones, real, real stiff ones. It's getting harder and harder for me to, you know, decompress after a show. Now, I see people running along the Embarcadero. That's okay. That's one way to decompress. My way of decompressing is having a very stiff drink or two. I think that's also a very good way to decompress. I don't think there's any evidence that running your heart out is going to have you live any longer than drinking a couple of drinks at night. But anyway, that's my opinion. I'm going to tell you right now that when I saw this story on CNBC, I almost fell out of the chair, and I've seen virtually everything by now. The Federal Reserve was forced to release details of who they lent the $3.3 trillion to during the crisis that was created by George Bush, George Soros,
and the others who melted us down in order to give us Obama. You're not going to believe who got the money. Well, we know that American banks got the money. Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo. One could argue that there is a rationale for bailing out American banks, although I wouldn't argue that necessarily, in that the people weren't bailed out. It was the bankers who were bailed out. Take a look at the bonuses they've given themselves since the bailout. But let's put that aside. The blockbuster is that foreign banks also took your money and ran. Barclays Bank, Royal Bank of Scotland, and Deutsche Bank were among the big borrowers. But what's even more disturbing is that Barclays Bank borrowed a cumulative $232 billion from the funds. And what did they do with it? They bought an American company. They bought all the U.S. operations of Lehman Brothers. And Lehman Brothers was forced into bankruptcy by the other gangsters of Wall Street. And a foreign bank borrows money from our government and picks up the pieces from Lehman Brothers. It's beyond comprehension. Bank of Scotland of the UK, Societe Generale of France, Dresdner Bank, Bayerische Landesbank of Germany, Dexia of Belgium, were all among the top 10 users of American money under George Bush. How do you feel about that? Do you think it was appropriate for George Bush and Christopher Cox and then Treasury Secretary Paulson to lend money to foreign banks during the fake crisis that was created in order to give us a panic attack and make us vote for an unknown man from Chicago who has now proven himself to be the most incompetent, dangerous president in American history? I want to read you something. First of all, I want to repeat what I just said to you on the Savage Nation. As the euro crisis is spreading to Spain and Portugal and Italy, and the euro itself is collapsing, hitting a 10-week low, the United States is now going to bail out the euro. But we just learned that the United States under George Bush bailed out these foreign banks. So there's virtually no difference in fiscal policy between what George Bush started and what Obama is continuing. It's the same exact governmental policy, but you don't understand this. It's a shell game. But I, Michael Savage, have pointed out that the Democrats or Republicans are an oligarchy. I've said this since 1994 on the radio, and well before 1994, before I was on the radio. Now, let's boil it down to what you, the person in the street, should take away from this. You think that the money doesn't really hurt anybody. You think that the money that disappeared under Bush and Christopher Cox disappeared. You don't understand that the value of America's assets were driven down by more than $10 trillion in 2008 under George Bush. You don't understand there was an agenda lurking behind the shadowy dealings, all pointed out in trickle-up poverty. But I ask you this, where did those dollars go? I'll read this to you from page 80 of Trickle-Up Poverty. They ended up in the hands of a relatively small number of people and companies whose purpose was far more nefarious than merely making profits. The raiders who trashed our markets sought nothing less than to use the control they had gained over our financial system to put a wet behind the ears leftist president in office. Moreover, they leveraged that power to create a government run on socialist principles, but controlled by a small group of wealthy investors who dictate policy to the puppet president they elected. In effect, they pushed us further along the path to a socialist oligarchy, reference number one in Trickle Up Poverty, Nightmare on Wall Street. Another player in the financial meltdown is leftist financier George Soros, who some believe has been trying for decades to manipulate American politics to the advantage of the Marxists with whom he is in league. It seems to me that Soros tried to rig the 2004 election in favor of John Kerry. How? By pouring tens of millions of dollars into Kerry's campaign coffers and into building an anti-capitalist, anti-democratic organization such as MoveOn.org. In spite of that massive investment, was Soros successful? No. Did he give up? Far from it. During the next few years, you'll have to read the rest yourself on pages 80, 81. What is the take-home message of what I read to you? Here is the take-home message. You're an average person. You're worried about your family. You're worried about your bills. If you're like me, you have your savings in T-bills because there's no interest anywhere, so you're basically putting it under the mattress, and you assume that guy Ben Bernanke is going to protect you. You assume that the Treasury Secretary, that idiot Geithner, who goes to a stupid comedian from Brooklyn for advice on how to run the economy, you think that that schmuck is going to protect your money? You think that spitting idiot in the Treasury Department knows what the hell he's doing? He doesn't know anything. He may as well be an OPA fish. He may as well be an OPA fish in the Treasury Department. So we learned today the Federal Reserve is finally forced to reveal who they gave the money to during the crisis that was created by these secret hands. $3.3 trillion is a lot of money. So I gave you the banks that got the money. One could argue, well, it prevented a meltdown of epic proportions. But why should we bail out Barclays Bank of London, Royal Bank of Scotland, and Deutsche Bank among the other borrowers? Why is that? Now, you would argue because it's an international banking community, and if they collapsed, why then there would be a domino effect and the whole world would collapse. I would argue to the contrary. I would say that if the European and other American banks that were over-leveraged or invested in spurious securities or false fiduciary instruments that they created in order to profit from them went out of business, it's too damn bad. Then we'd have fewer banks, but healthier banks. And these practices that were used to get us in the hot water in the first place would be over. So why did we bail out the European banks? It had nothing to do with saving the international monetary system. It had all to do with their cousins in America bailing out their cousins and fraternity brothers in Europe. You don't understand something. The banking community is a very small, tight-knit community. What goes on in Germany or England or New York or San Francisco banks is done by a few hands. 6 to 15 people control the world's economy. They're bailing each other out with your money, and we're the idiots, we're the patsies. Savage.